Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwen Sheltimer, my co-host, Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, Richard Pope. Each week at this time, we visit with a local author, we get an introduction to their work, perhaps a glimpse into their lives, and maybe find out what prompts them to write. We also have an opportunity to hear them read from their work. And this week, we're very pleased to have Richard. Richard is a retired professor of Russian literature, history, and culture. He has written a number of books published by Dundurn Press, including Me and Len, Life in the Halliburton Bush, 1900 to 1940, and several about birds, most notably The Reluctant Twitcher, a quite truthful account of my big year in birding, and a novel, Superior Illusions, an epic poem which describes life on the Voyager route in the 18th century between Lachine and Grand Portage, the summer meeting place of the Voyageurs. This year, Richard has released his new self-published novel, Shadows Gathering, which explores life on the home front at the beginning of World War I and the front line in 1915. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
Your new novel has a complex background and narrative. Can you give us a brief introduction to the story?
Yes, it opens in the Ontario countryside on August the 6th, 1914, not August the 4th, although that was when the British declared war on Germany, but August the 6th when people in the countryside in Canada and the colonies found out about it. It's set in any small town in rural Ontario, though actually it's based on sort of an amalgam of Halliburton and Huntsville, two towns that I knew particularly well. It presents the daily life and the social issues of a rather ethnically mixed rural society, follows the lives and the loves and the hopes of hardworking villagers who are forced to cope with a mysterious rape and murder in their community, and then on top of this, the war itself. Several sections in the book purport to be newspaper articles where a woman's reading the newspaper of the day, and many of the concerns of village life are presented there. It follows the life and toil in the logging camps and the village and in the farm fields, and eventually more and more it details the growing effect of the news of the war, the effect on the locals, which beginning as ignorance and wild enthusiasm and eventually becomes one of horror. And it follows the lives of four particularly young men from their home, their small hometown, down to Valcartier in Quebec and across the ocean to England, to Salisbury Plain, where they trained for 6 months. And then eventually we followed them to the front in April of 1915, when the Eastern Ontario Regiment, the 2nd Battalion, managed to arrive in time for the Second Battle of Ypres and were sent into the line from reserve just in time to take the second ever chlorine gas attack on April the 24th. So that's the background and the main idea of the novel.
Well, it's really packed.
It is.
Now, something that caught my ear was the fact that we're following four locals in rural Ontario. So how much general history have you included around small towns at that time?
Well, there's a good deal of general history. Of course, the background of the times percolates through the book. The particular town, Waterford, serves as a metaphor for the rural life of the times. And of course, I did, being a professor, I did a massive amount of research for the novel and read many, many books, the best of which was Barbara Tuchman's wonderful Guns of August. Margaret Macmillan's wonderful new book had not yet been written, nor had Tim Cook's two-volume history of the Canadian war effort at the sharp end. But I read a lot of military history as well as general history, particularly battalion histories. There's a wonderful history of the 2nd Battalion, which was our Eastern Ontario Regiment, and the letters and diaries of soldiers. But I think the most interesting and best field of research was the newspapers of the times, those that didn't get burnt out, because most of the old newspapers were kept in wooden buildings and they got burnt out sooner or later. But the Huntsville Forester, for example, the Lindsay Post, the Peterborough Examiner, the Lindsay Watchman Warder, these newspapers survived and are on microfilm in the Ontario archives, and you can go back and pick your August the 6th day in these small rural communities and read the newspapers and see what people were thinking and what was being said. Maclean's magazine, Saturday Night, The Farmer's Advocate, a number of magazines, I looked at those and read the articles, of course, and the history of the times, but also the advertisements. When you read any of these newspapers or journals, they're crammed with advertisements, and the advertisements tell you what the real concerns of the day were. Corns and warts, you know, and hemorrhoids, constipation, a fixation on bowels, flypaper, you know, blackheads, boils, you know, salves and bombs. And,
so nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed. This is what the people were interested in, obviously, or the papers and magazines wouldn't have been crammed full of it. And these are wonderful historical sources, first-hand sources, rather than going to history books that other people have put together. So that was sort of the way I approached the historical research for the book.
Now, yes, we're all interested in all those things that are advertised, but I'm sure at that time, obviously, war must have been on everybody's mind. And I'm wondering, we don't often think of the effects of war in Canada. It's, you know, it's always out overseas in Europe and so on. So how did the war affect communities in the area that you were writing about, mainly the Muskoka area?
Well, of course, it affected them ever more greatly. At the beginning, it didn't affect them very much. In the countryside, people didn't know much. They weren't educated people. There was no television. They didn't really read newspapers. And the war, if it was going to take place, was overseas, and the general feeling was it wouldn't have much effect on life. There was, of course, an enthusiastic backing of Great Britain and great excitement among the young people. And as the war effort started to gather momentum, there was a lot of nationalistic fervor, of course, and patriotism, pride in the young men in the communities, and a great desire to send the best of the young men off. Now, you also asked, how did the war affect the communities? Well, very little at first, other than there were fewer people, of course, to take in the crops, fewer people to work in the logging camps and tend the farms. And the local women, of course, knitted socks and raised money and had socials and things like that. But it didn't really affect the communities greatly until the first telegram started coming in April and May of 1915, telling these people that their children were dead. And a devastating sense of reality kicks in when these first terse cables announcing your son's death. There were huge casualties at the Second Battle of Ypres. In a space of about 48 hours, in April 22nd to the 24th, our 2nd Battalion, the Eastern Ontario Regiment, had 543 casualties out of 1,000 men.
Oh, wow.
And the Canadian contingent, the 1st Canadian contingent, the first division we ever sent over, had 6,000 casualties out of 18,000 men, roughly a third. So devastating damage done to the men, and this was not as it was supposed to be. And this, of course, percolated down to the home front and out in the towns, and everything changed in the way they regarded the war. The patriotism and jingoism and fervor soon disappeared, with shock and horror replacing it.
Wow. Well, perhaps you could read us a little from Shadows Gathering.
Well, I'll read a brief passage from the beginning of the book, sort of putting things in order. The book opens with the announcement of the war in the fields. The men are out cradling with their scythes and taking in the wheat, and other men are taking in the hay in other fields, and they hear about the war. Sitting in the shade of the hay wagon, the men were eating their lunch and complaining about the heat. Scotty, Black Bill's sheepdog, was lying as if dead underneath the wagon, exhausted from a tension-filled morning dispatching mice and grass snakes that scurried out from under the hay coils as the boys forked them onto the wagon. It was right at this time that the men spotted a white apparition making its way towards them over the stubble. No one was watching more intently than Billy Irwin. It was Chicken Jimmy who first said, "That's Anna Kozlowski, ain't it? Looks like she's bringing us a pail of cold water, bless her soul." At the mention of Anna's name, Billy blushed beet red and smiled sheepishly. "Yeah, that's her," he said as he got up and began walking across the field to meet her. When she was about halfway to the wagon, Anna stopped and yelled something indistinct. She sounded excited. "What the hell'd she say?" Clarence was puzzled. "We got more or something?" No one had made out what she'd said. Billy began to run, and the men saw him reach her, exchange a few words, take the water pail, and begin to race back towards the wagon with her, apparently infected by her excitement. When they arrived at the wagon, Anna brushed her kerchief back, and taking a deep breath, said, "We're at war!" Some of the men looked at her in disbelief, others in incomprehension. Old Black Dan stopped wetting his cradle scythe, and even the horses momentarily looked up from their oat bags, sensing something untoward in their voice. Only Billy showed scant concern and simply stood staring in admiration, thinking how beautiful Anna was with her cheeks flushed and how lovely she looked in those funny little kerchiefs she always wore in her head. "War?" Old Man Moore was incredulous. "What do you mean, war? I thought they'd all kissed and made up. Where'd you hear about that?" "Mr. Tupper received a message by telegraph at the post office last night and again this morning. Mr. Tupper says King George declared war on Tuesday evening, and if England's at war, so are we. Should be in the newspaper today. Mrs. McMahon and Maudie have gone to Waterford, and they're bringing copies back of the recorder for everyone tonight." Clarence recovered his composure. "Well, it's just like I've been saying all along. I knew it was coming. It's on account of that Archduke lad that went and got himself murdered there. You can be sure of that. I had the feeling all along something bad would come of it. Seems your Germany and your France want to have it out. See who can lick who. And them bastards is going to drag all the other countries into their scrap. Old Tupper's right. If England's fighting, we'll be in it with her." Chicken Jimmy Scott was full of righteous anger. "Well, it's high time someone gave those goddamn Frenchmen a good licking. They're way out of line. God damn it, if I wasn't so old, I'd join up myself right now. Damn right I would." "Frenchman is out of line," agreed Old Man Moore pensively. "But we ain't fighting the French, Jimmy." Anna looked timidly down at her feet. I think England declared war on Germany," she said. "Not to anyone in particular." "Aye, to be sure," said Old Man Moore. "That's just what I'm trying to tell Jimmy here. Them Frenchmen needs a good pruning, but it's your Germans we're fighting. The Germanic nation, Jimmy," he said authoritatively. "The Germanic nation." Ike Irwin was dismayed. "Can't help but wonder what the hell we're fighting them for. Some of the best people around here is Germans. Look at old Jacob Walters. First person to help anybody raising the barn or putting up a stone chimbley is old Jacob and his boys. Germans is good people." "Well," replied Old Man Moore, "I hold for the British Isles, and if we got to teach Fritz a lesson, so be it." Chicken Jimmy could no longer contain himself. "Fritz is the best goddamn neighbor I ever had. Last week he gave me 2 whole days on my new wire fence. I ain't..." Clarence interrupted him in full flight. "Not Fritz Neiman, Jimmy. Fritz is your Germans altogether, do you see? We won't be fighting the good ones here. Hell no. The Neimans, the Walders, and old Gustav Tupper is our friends. Our lads will be going over to your Europe to fight him over there. We'll just straighten out that Kaiser lad, and everything will be all right. Well, if we're going hundreds of miles for scrap, we might as well kick a few Frenchmen's arses while we're over there. I ain't never seen a Frenchman didn't need his arse kicked yet." Jimmy was out of sorts, fighting the Germans instead of the goddamn Frenchmen. It won't affect us in any way, I hope," asked Black Bill. I mean, what with the hay and the grain and everything, we got enough problems." "No, Bill, I don't suppose it will," said Clarence. "The fighting will all be over in Europe, and I doubt it'll last long enough for our boys to get there. Oh, we'll stand with England, no doubt about it, but mark my words, it won't last long, and it won't make no difference to us here in Fox's Creek."
Oh, well, little do they know. Thanks very much, Richard. Now we'll take a short break.
Thank you.